ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The Country Hour. I'm Cassie Huff with you today, and we are going to be looking at a couple of different sides to social media, given under 16s are now banned from using social media. There's the positive community-based side, and we'll delve into that by looking at the Harvesting the Crop page, which now has more than 100,000 followers and has built a space for farmers to connect when it comes to particularly grain growing, but it's a space for farmers and a bit of a community, but also we're going to look at what it means for students, particularly remote students.
I think the timing hasn't been thought of well, because the 10th of December is when kids are going home from school. You know, they're on holidays, they're away from, you know, all of those support networks. So all of those borders don't have that wonderful support and circle of care around them that they would have normally during term time.
I'll get into that soon. But you might have heard this referred to as Farmageddon, where there were concerns around the viability of farming in the US. Well, President Donald Trump this week has unveiled a $12 billion aid package for American farmers affected by the fallout of his tariffs. It's going to help farmers buy seeds, fertilizer, and other expenses for next year's growing season. Natasha Kemp is the head of food, beverage, and agribusiness at ING Australia, and she explains to Megan Hughes what the impact will be on Aussie farmers.
To break that down, so that's about $12 billion US is about Australian dollar equivalent of about $18 billion. And that's really going to support farmers that are farming what they call row crops. So major crops such as corn, soybean, wheat, cotton and rice. And they're getting the bulk of the support for about $11 billion. And then there's a little bit of support. That's $1 billion for specialty crops, fruit, nuts and vegetables. So they're basically direct cash transfers that are going into the accounts of the US farmers. And we understand that to be happening in February next year. And so what that is really doing is supporting those farmers. You know, potentially they've had high input costs, or they might have been seeing lower costs of their various commodity. And so that bridge payment is just to really bolster that segment of the economy.
So how have they been impacted by these tariffs and this trade war that the administration has been in?
So just say, you know, we all look at the trade war being US and China specific, but actually it's potentially lesser known retaliatory tariffs that actually might have been affecting them. So for example, the US export a lot of soybean into China. They've stopped doing that this year, and I think it wasn't until September this year, or actually maybe even October, that the first soybean exports into China happened. So as a result, you know, there's a lot of soybean in the market trying to find a home, and really that has an impact on, or could have an impact on, price. In the interesting sort of, what I'd say, a juxtaposition is that the price of soybeans actually went up this year because they were using it for alternative fuels and things like that. But the other sort of row crops like corn and wheat, that the price of those commodities has fallen.
What does this mean for Australian farmers, because Australia is sending a lot of red meat, in particular cattle and goat meat, into the US market? And I guess, you know, where they're not sending grains into the US market, they will be competing with the US into markets like China. So would this subsidy have a bit of a backlash on Australian farmers?
Some, but not all. So let's start with the broadacre crops like grains and oilseeds. So I think you're right in terms of it's likely to have downward pressure on price. But in addition to that, we're coming into another really large Australian crop. But globally, the supply of grain is high. So potentially you would see, or it would follow, that the price of those grains would fall. So you would argue not great for an Australian farmer growing those crops. You know, that said, the crop is in plentiful supply, and you know, I think, you know, you always have these issues with supply and demand. So I think over sort of long range, you think 2-3 year time, I think there might be a temporary price dip, but you would expect a recovery. For our beef farmers, I think for example, if you use that example, the cost of grain is going down, that actually potentially has a really good effect on beef producers. So you think a lot of our beef will eventually go into a feedlot, and you would be feeding those animals things like grain, soybean. So therefore, the cost of that import would go down. And so potentially there is actually an opportunity for those processors or some of those farmers potentially to see better outcomes there. In addition, and this is kind of how I always think of food and agri, it's all like, you know, a global ecosystem. We still have a great opportunity here in Australia to support beef into the US. So they are still at a low point in their herd, and they will continue to rebuild their herd. And as a result, the Australian beef is required over in the US. So we think that, you know, we don't really see this support or this one-off support for the US farmers necessarily impacting beef and livestock producers here in Australia in the short term. Mm. It potentially actually might benefit them by way of cheaper input prices in terms of the feed.
Do you think there'll be a case of exporters and growers choosing to just store grain and oil seeds to wait for better prices?
Potentially. I think that's always the million-dollar question, isn't it? Do you keep... You know, you've obviously got to pay for storage, or a lot of farmers are now have already invested in a lot of on-farm storage. So do you hold expecting the price to go up or not? I think, you know, that's something that I think most farmers would have an understanding of, and in terms of that would be their strategy. I wouldn't comment on that because it just really depends on, I guess, various things like farmer cash flow and cost of storage and things like that.
Yeah, so like an individual decision rather than an industry decision.
Yeah, exactly. But even like, for example, there might be farmers that, you know, might need to sell now because they're looking to do some capital works coming up, or, you know, as we get closer to the end of the financial year, they might delay selling, you know, due to, you know, various implications around tax or cash flow. So, yeah, I think it's a really individual sort of set of circumstances that each farmer works through.
Natasha Kemp is the head of food, beverage and agribusiness at ING Australia, and she was speaking to Megan Hughes. Now, representatives of the state's oyster industry this morning gave evidence into a state parliamentary inquiry into the impacts of the harmful algal bloom. Selena Green has more.
This morning's sitting of the Joint Committee on Harmful Algal Blooms in South Australia focused on the impact of the bloom and subsequent closures have had on the oyster industry. Some growers have been unable to move or sell oysters for several months on end, while others have not been directly impacted by the bloom in their local waters. Peter Treloar, the independent chair of the South Australian Oyster Growers Association, was first to give evidence.
I guess the impact of the harmful algal bloom and the closures has not been evenly spread. We've talked about those adjacent Gulf, St Vincent, and also the Franklin Harbour growers, but at the same time, all of our growers, and that is the majority of the oyster industry in South Australia on the West Coast, have been unaffected by the HAB and have been unaffected and not impacted at all by any closures. So I'm talking about Coffin Bay, where probably half of the South Australian oyster industry is situated. Coffin Bay up to Streaky Bay, Haslam, Smoky Bay and Denial Bay, Ceduna, have remained open in this period. So the impacts have been severe and significant for those impacted growers. The majority of our growers haven't been impacted.
Three oyster growers also gave evidence to the inquiry. The first of those was Megan Turner, who owns Turner's Oyster Farm with her husband in Franklin Harbour on the east coast of the Eyre Peninsula. Their business was shut down at the end of July due to elevated brevetoxin levels, and they've only just been given the all clear to reopen.
We've been farming oysters for 30 years and our business employs local people and, you know, we personally contribute about $1 million to the local regional economy each year. We've got 8 staff, including ourselves, and we're now down to 5 after the impact of the bloom. So, as Peter said, Franklin Harbour was closed for 121 days. We've now been open again for 9 business days, and we're certainly moving oysters again, which is a huge relief. Having said that, during the closure, we lost about $500,000 in revenue from direct sales, and potentially that again from indirect impacts over the next 12 to 18 months due to issues with not putting in seed during that spring window, oyster seed that is, that will grow for the next, you know, year or so, and also from poor oyster health from the bloom and its vulnerability to grading. We had mortalities and stock losses of 25% in some batches. So across Franklin Harbour growers, there could be, you know, around a $2.5 million loss in direct sales and other impacts alone from this bloom.
Megan Turner also told the inquiry about the ongoing challenges with testing and interstate movement of South Australian oysters.
From a food safety perspective, it's been really reassuring there's been no cases of neurotoxic shellfish poisoning from this event. So the shutdowns certainly worked. However, there's been times when we've been, at the beginning we were closed when we were well under the cutoff, so we lost revenue when perhaps we didn't need to. The reason for that is because there's time lags with getting our brevetoxin results from our oyster meats of about 10 days up until recent, and that was with oysters going across to New Zealand for specific brevetoxin testing. That's too slow for a live product that moves immediately, and we certainly welcome the new accredited lab in Adelaide with the proposed 5-day turnaround. It's a big improvement. It still, however, may not be workable in practice. Our oysters are often interstate by day 5 and often not yet consumed. So if results come back high, which can happen because we're still 10 or even 5 days out, we could face a recall of product we sent 4 or 5 days ago. And because the live oyster import restrictions by PRRS are applied, once our product leaves the state, it effectively cannot be brought back into the state for biosecurity reasons. So in the case of a recall without ministerial approval, that product of ours has to be destroyed and we don't get payment for that. So we just ask in Franklin Harbour, because we still do have low levels of toxin present and we are open for sales, that the committee consider recommending a dedicated recall return policy or exemption for us. So that might allow timely and safe return of oysters that may still be in trucks and haven't actually gone into the processor's room or been exposed to other oysters from other areas. Another thing that I ask is that we get a lot of support behind on-the-spot rapid test kits for us to use as growers on harvest days. So these rapid test kits have been in the pipeline and discussed since August, and they're currently being researched and developed in Tasmania. These test kits basically show a positive or a negative under the brevetoxin cutoff, so that would give us confidence as growers to sell without the risk of recall. So we are of the understanding that these test kits may be available for use early next year, but we really can't get them quick enough at this stage.
Franklin Harbour oyster grower Megan Turner. Stansbury oyster farmer Paul Dee is the Oyster Association's Eastern Zone representative covering the Gulf of St Vincent around to the northern coast of Kangaroo Island. He told the inquiry that more industry support was needed.
Our concern is having our harvest areas closed due to brevetoxin accumulated in oysters. Levels of brevetoxin change each week and remain high at the moment. Carinia cristata, identified as a producer of brevetoxin, as we know, But us growers, we still have concerns of what other drivers and associated species of Carinia can contribute to brevetoxin. Carinia species is zero along the eastern York Peninsula at the moment. Carinia has increased rapidly in the American River harvesting area last week, along with counts of brevetoxin causing closure again for harvesting oysters in that region. We want to be able to survive as oyster growing areas of the eastern zone in Gulf St Vincent of South Australia and need ongoing support from the state government. We are very concerned about our future and are in need for further financial support.
Stansbury oyster farmer Paul D giving evidence this morning to the Joint Committee on Harmful Algal Blooms in South Australia. The inquiry continues and Selena Green put that report together. It's 20 past 12.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Weather's up next, but this is certainly getting a lot of attention today. The social media ban, the timing for the national social media ban for children under the age of 16 has seen boarding schools scrambling for ways to help students navigate being cut off from their friends over the school holidays. The ban becomes law right as 76% of Australia's 21,000 boarders head back to their remote and regional homes. More than half of these are in year 10 and below and are expected to be cut off from social media platforms like TikTok and Instagram from today. And I'd be interested to know what you think it'll be like for your children if you're affected by this. You can text me 0467 922 783 or call 1300 160 222. The Australian Boarding Schools Association Chief Executive Richard Stokes told reporter Jodie Hamilton there were concerns some rural students could be feeling more isolated.
That's a real risk. We should be alert to that fact and keep our eyes open. Now, the thing that I'm really worried about, I think the timing hasn't been thought of well, because the 10th of December is when kids are going home from school. You know, they're on holidays, they're away from, you know, all of those support networks. So all of those boarders don't have that wonderful support and circle of care around them that they would have normally during term time. So they're going to be, you know, not only away from that, but then also away from all of their friends. So they can't even talk to them. Yeah, they'll have to find ways to do it. So we're a bit worried about that whole mental health issue in that space.
Is there anything being looked at to help transition students away from social media?
We need to do a little bit of work teaching our students how to be in contact with their friends once they're not able to do it on the social media platforms, because they use Snapchat and Instagram chat all the time. That's how they talk to their friends. And so they're going to be, of course, at home on holidays when this ban starts, and then potentially have, you know, their way of connecting with their friends cut off completely.
Do you think that boarding students perhaps are in a unique position where maybe they do have some distance away from their friends?
Absolutely they do. One of the things that our boarding schools have been very good at doing is restricting technology use after hours. You know, particularly at night time when the kids are, you know, when they're supposed to be going to bed and whatever, they have to hand in their technology and they don't get it back until the next day. They often have quite restricted hours depending on their age as well. They've been doing that. But one of the problems that we've got is that those boarders are spread out not only all across Australia, but even all across the world. Their way of keeping in touch with their friends, they, you know, like you and I might text each other or send an email, but that's definitely not a process that young people use to keep in touch with each other. And so it's going to be a really interesting space for those kids. 76% of our boarders are rural and remote. They're kids that actually grow up in the country and don't have a choice but to go to boarding school because that's the only way that they would get a high school education. And they actually have to leave home to be able to go to school. So they are quite removed from their own sort of even circles of friends. And if they go home from the boarding school, they go home to their property, which could be a long way away from anybody else. It can be a very lonely space. And we don't really want that to be the case, because that loneliness can cause all sorts of issues.
Have boarding staff members seen some negative impacts of social media?
Oh, heck yes. It's one of those big challenges. And I guess one of the good things about boarding school is that by removing their devices at night, you're in a situation where you're actually sort of giving them some space to be able to do that. What we find is, you know, it's really quite fascinating. By removing the devices from the kids, then they become quite social again. You know, if I think back to my early days of working in boarding, the kids spent a lot of time doing things together. you know, both actively and even on, you know, watching TV and stuff like that. They were really good at it. And when they've got their head down on their own device, you know, being on some sort of social media platform, that really takes that away.
So boarding schools might in fact be a step ahead of, say, parents at home who are struggling to get the media off their children.
100%. Absolutely. Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Most of the schools would in some fashion try and give their older students, their year 11s or particularly their year 12s, the opportunity to prove that they can be more responsible with their devices, you know, and maybe leave them on weekends or even some nights during the week. But still, a lot of boarding schools are taking them away from all of the kids because, you know, it's all about sleep. One of the things that we're going to have to come to terms with is actually working on ways for kids to be in touch with their friends. You know, when I grew up, it was the phone in the middle of the house that Mum and Dad could listen to no matter who I was talking to. Or we made plans when we were at school and we then followed them through, you know, later on in the day. That's definitely not the life of a teenager today. And we're going to have to actually teach them some of the skills to make sure that they can be in contact with their friends during the holidays. Otherwise, they're going to be quite lonely.
Australian Boarding Schools Association CEO Richard Stokes. Port Lincoln boarder Annabelle Bowie is from Lock-on-Air Peninsula, and she'll only be affected by the ban for a few months until she turns 16. Her friendship group is looking for alternatives on how to stay in touch over the holiday break.
We all use it after school, and because we have study in the boarding house, we're not allowed our phones for about an hour and a half, and then we also have dinner where we're not allowed our phones at all. Some of the younger people get their phones taken away. So last year I got my phone taken away from 9:30.
Was that a good thing?
Yeah, I think it was a good thing because it gave me time to sleep, because sometimes when you're laying in bed, you just, you know, you see your phone there and you're like, oh, I better check one more time. So it made my sleep schedule a lot more healthier. It'll be good for a lot of the very younger ones, because I know a lot of younger, maybe 10-year-olds who have social media who aren't particularly mature enough for that. But for people more like my age who are almost 16 and on the sort of edge, it's hard because it'll be holidays when it first comes in. So for boarders like me and some of my friends, we won't be able to connect with each other as much while we don't see each other, which will be a big jump from talking to each other every day and living with each other to not talking at all.
Some people are saying perhaps just pick up the phone or use text message.
We're all going to swap numbers and stuff and still talk, but I know a lot of people who don't like using Messenger.
How often do you get in touch with your friends?
I talk to them a lot. We'd have catch-ups and stuff. Like, sometimes we're in group chats where we talk about what happened that day or something like that. But it's not very often, maybe once a week. I'll talk to some of my friends from the boarding house if I don't see them.
So is it the ability of that social media to have group chats and things like that that's the difference perhaps between, you know, old-school media where you just send a text message?
Yeah, it's definitely different. Like, having group chats feels more inclusive with everyone, and I can talk to everyone at once and I don't have to message everyone individually if I'm asking a question to everyone.
So what do you think about the ban?
I think it'll be good. I think it'll be a good experience to see how I cope without having social media. I think I'll be fine, but there's a lot of people that I don't am not too confident with. Because I live in such a small town, I might go to my grandma and grandpa's farm a lot more and do a lot more jobs around the house, hopefully, stuff like that.
I'm sure your grandparents and parents will love that. They're going to be even more in favour of this. That was Annabelle Bowie speaking to Jodie Hamilton there. What do you make of the social media ban? You can call me on 1300 160222 or text 0467 92783. Krista from the Riverland says, kids forget they have text messaging. I've been thinking the same thing. I have an 18-year-old and an almost 16, and they never seem to call or text friends anymore and rely on apps instead. We are very data reliant these days. I mean, I know at my parents' place, we actually don't really get mobile service anymore and are completely reliant on data for everything, which is a different story and a terrifying prospect in and of itself. But yeah, it does seem like the phone has gone by the wayside a little. But to keep those texts coming as we head into the weather, senior forecaster Mark Analak joins me. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie.
So how are things looking? It's warming up across South Australia this week.
Yeah, we'll start with what's happening in the north of the state, where we have a severe heatwave warning for the northwest pastoral and northeast pastoral districts. A lot of heat still over the central parts of Australia with the trough there. And that trough may trigger some thunderstorms this afternoon. We're starting to see some thunderstorms in the far northwest, and there is a risk that those thunderstorms could develop into severe thunderstorms later today. So there is a potential for a severe thunderstorm warning for the far northwest corner of the state. Keep an eye on that one. Further south, this morning we had a fair bit of high-level cloud drifting across agricultural areas. It did produce a little bit of shower activity through sort of Kangaroo Island and Fleurieu Peninsula, sort of up a millimetre, maybe a millimetre or two, not a huge amount. And that middle-level cloud is now starting to drift eastwards over eastern districts to clear the state later this afternoon. Over the next couple of days, we'll see some of that warmth from northern parts of the state head southwards, so warming up across agricultural areas. And also the unsettled conditions drag further south as well. So thunderstorms are possible through the Eyre Peninsula and mid-north, northern parts of York Peninsula tomorrow afternoon. Just a slight risk, but a risk nonetheless. But as we move into Friday, that's really our day of concern. Very hot conditions, northerly winds across the state. We'll see elevated fire dangers for many, many districts, particularly through western and central parts. And also there's a pretty fresh southwesterly wind change that will come through during Friday as well. So the combination of that very warm conditions and those stronger winds coming through in the southwesterlies may see an increase in fire dangers across western and central parts of the state. That change continues to move eastwards, northeastwards across the state through the weekend, bringing more stable conditions across the state and temperatures returning to below average for the weekend before it starts to rise again next week with the winds turning northerly again. In terms of rainfall amounts, there's not much expected. Might get a rumble of thunder, but most of these thunderstorms are expected to be dry thunderstorms with little to no rainfall. If you get a millimetre or two somewhere across the state, you're lucky. I don't think we'll see much more than that over the next 3 or 4 days. Cassie.
Thanks so much for that, Mark. Mark Anilak there from the Bureau of Meteorology. In the far west of New South Wales, the upper western will be partly cloudy with a high chance of showers in the east, only a slight chance elsewhere. There could be a thunderstorm around as well, and it will be quite windy. Overnight temperatures, though, falling to the mid to low 20s, and the daytime temperatures reaching around 40 degrees. The lower western will be partly cloudy. There is a medium chance of showers in the northeast, most likely in the afternoon and evening. Also, there's a chance of a thunderstorm as well. Overnight temperatures falling to between 16 to 21 degrees, and the daytime temperatures reaching the mid to high 30s. It's 28 minutes to 1.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Coming up on the Country Hour, we've been talking about the social media ban from an under-16s point of view, but it has also created a community, so much so that a very popular ag social media site, Harvesting the Crop, has now cracked 100,000 followers. And we will be hearing about that shortly. And also we will hear from the Haywire winners as well. But as I was saying, if you're looking for advice on an air seeder breakdown, to get some information on bush mechanicking, or perhaps you'd like to share a glorious sunset picture from your tractor cap, there's a good chance you've been to the Harvesting the Crop Facebook page. It started in 2013. It now has more than 100,000 members. And it's a place where farmers from across the country, yeah, and indeed actually the world, go to see the highs and lows of reaping, seeding and growing the crop here in Australia. Administrator and creator of the page, John Gladigo, explains how it came to be.
I was actually running a farm page for our farm, Bullabara, for a number of years, and we grew to having about 30,000 followers in the group. And so we had a lot of followers and a lot of interaction, but we started having a lot of people who started sending me photographs and requests for information and looking for information for other farmers. And I thought, well, there's actually no real group on Facebook that I'm aware of where croppers can come together and ask each other questions and brag about what they do and show off some of their machinery and the like. So I thought, I'll just set up a little page and call it Harvesting the Crop and invite people to come and join that. And that's really how it started. And that was back in 2013, I think.
Did you ever imagine it was going to grow to the size it has?
I never, ever imagined it would even get close to that. I mean, it was just a little tiny side project, really, for me, and just a little bit of fun. And really, for the first few years, it only had like 2,000 or 3,000 people that were in the group, which I guess is still a lot, but it sort of sat around those numbers. And it was only in 2018, that was 5 years later, that it hit 20,000. And after that, it was when it really exploded. And I think it created its own growth. Both really like an internal fire. It was quite amazing, and I think it's a bit unusual in that we managed to keep all the spam off the page, and we managed to keep it really well focused, and so people coming to the page knew what they were getting. They're getting a very safe place where, you know, you could actually ask, you know, quite specific, detailed, you know, cropping, machinery, agronomic type questions, and actually know you'd get a sensible answer. And I think that's what's really been quite unique about the page.
Do you have to moderate it much at all?
Look, a little bit. I mean, we've got some rules around what we would like to see on the page, and because it's become so huge, it's a place where everyone wants to advertise their farm machinery or for jobs or for work wanted, and that's sort of not what the page is all about. And so, you know, we have to moderate that part of it quite heavily to keep it the page clean of that, and also spams. I mean, spammers and scammers just absolutely love large pages, and so we've had to put some pretty strict rules in place. And the moderators and the admins have to, you know, they do spend quite a bit of time just making sure that the page is kept clean. And I think the fact that it is so clean and doesn't have all of those, you know, the clickbaits on it, I guess, that's what makes it, I think, quite a unique and special place for farmers to come to. I was just looking through the stats just then. And in the last 30 days, there's been 11,000 posts and comments on the page and 4.8 million views of the posts.
My gosh.
Which is just nuts.
Is that just Australia? Or do you have a global reach? Obviously, a global reach given it's a social media platform, but are there many international people interested in it?
We do. Look, it is predominantly Australia, but I think of the 103,000 people that are in the group currently, looking at my numbers here now, I think it's 82,000 of those are Australian. And we try and keep it very much Australian focused and to Australian issues as well. And so for those that are in the rest of the world, it's really like their window into Australian agriculture. Pretty much, and we try not to allow too much where it becomes, you know, issues that might be happening in the US or in Europe as such, and keep it very much focused on what's happening right here.
And you mentioned great photos there, and you do get some great photos on your page, so much so that to celebrate reaching 100,000 people on your site, you had a photo competition. What inspired this, and how did you do it?
Oh, no, we were just talking about what, as moderators, what could we actually do to celebrate 100,000 members? And look, the group's not about big prizes and about hoo-ha and it's just about honour and own personal pride, I suppose. And so because, you know, people do put up so many photos, we decided that we'd just create just a little competition and had six categories, you know, basically from, you know, bogged and busted to fields of green and gold to best looking farm dog to machinery selfie, the Shelby Ride Award, which is sort of like bush mechanicking as such, and the best looking smokos or people who create the best looking lunch boxes, I suppose. And we were quite shocked to get over 700 photos that were submitted into those six categories, and we chose some finalists and had people vote on those, and we had over 8,500 people or votes on those photos as well before we came up with some final some finalists, which is or some prizes, which was sensational.
All just from what was just your little page you started out with. Over 10 years ago now. That's amazing. Yeah. People must have been chuffed to get the message they'd won.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there is a real, you know, source of, you know, of pride within the group. And I think the reason the group has been so successful is because of the people who are part of the group. You know, I think that people do value it very highly. It's kind of like, in some ways, going to a really good field day or you know, meeting people, you know, down at the pub and just sort of sitting around and talking about things, but in a really comfortable environment and knowing that all the idiots aren't there. And that you can actually express an opinion and know that, you know, you'll be able to have a really good, you know, robust conversation around it. If you ask a question about something that's going on with your piece of machinery, that you know that you're going to get you know, a good response. There's probably nowhere that you're going to get a better response to that sort of a question than what you're going to get in this group. And that's what I'm really proud of. I'm proud of the fact that, look, yeah, I may have started the group, but I've in some ways lost control of it in a way. Look, it's now owned by the Cropping Farmers of Australia as their site, as their group, as their group where they come together to, you know, be the Aussie cropping family, which I think is just fantastic.
Harvesting the Crop Administrator and Creator, John Gladigo speaking there. Now, Louise Smith from McGee in the Mallee wasn't actually a part of the photo competition, but she recently put up a photo of her crop onto the site. She joins me now. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie.
So can you tell people what your picture was on the Harvesting the Crop page?
It was literally probably four or five heads of wheat sticking up out of drift sand.
It's quite an incredible picture. I don't think you would believe it if you hadn't taken a photo of it, just how deep the sand was at your place. How, just what have the conditions been like to have led to that?
It's just literally been wind event after wind event, and fair enough, that was on the edge of a track that's now come in probably 50 to 60 foot off of the track edge. But yeah, it's literally just wind has come through, taken the top soil across and just kept going and going and going. And I actually walked out because we did have a slightly green patch there before harvest, and I walked out to have a look, and I walked into it. I'm like, wow, like I've literally nearly walked off a cliff edge. That the drop down was like a foot deep into what was the crop long side. So yeah, it's just been continuous, relentless wind.
And were you able to reap as a result of it?
I stayed very much away from it because, yeah, I know I did catch the edge of it on a different sand hill, and I could actually just feel the header start to sink a bit, and you knew you were going to do damage if you got to it, and there's no point chasing two or three heads that are literally buried. It was, yeah, so it's 50 foot down one edge. You just don't go near. It's, yeah, don't go zone.
No. And what made you want to share it on the Harvesting the Crop page?
It's something probably different, and other people have probably looked and thought, oh, yeah, it's just a photo. But I'm like, we don't have U-Butte, new headers, new machinery. We're not reaping by any stretch of the imagination a decent crop. But it's just something totally different. Like, hey, well, this is what we've got. We don't have all your big flashy equipment, but we do have sand.
You certainly do, a lot of it. But why do you want to be a part of the Harvesting the Crop community that has developed over the last, what is it, 12, 13 years or so?
It's a really interesting group to follow because as you see what other people across the state, across Australia are doing as places you'll never get to see yourself. And it's just what they're doing with their equipment, what their farming programs are. And even if you pick up one or two little things different in even wheat varieties, and you think, oh, well, maybe that wheat variety will do okay in our area, and you just pick up little bits here and there. And funnily enough, a couple of years ago, I think it was probably 22 when we actually fired the header up last time, and we had a breakdown, and literally 2 days earlier we'd seen a post of someone looking for another part for their header, and someone piped up, oh, I've got an old header I'm wrecking, and the parts on that actually matched ours as well. So it's, yeah, it's just little bits of information, little bits here and there that you pick up, and it's, yeah, one very good page to be following just for the little bits you do pick up.
Yeah, it's very relevant to farmers, and there's a lot of engagement on there. There's always photos and things like that out of it. Do you just peruse out of interest, even if you're not looking for parts and things like that, to get a laugh? Because I know one of the categories was, I think, bogged and busted, so mistakes people have made, and just people have a bit of a laugh sometimes.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of good comedy coming out of it as well. And yeah, I probably, having looked at our header again quickly today, I probably could have entered, we'll put a photo up of, yeah, do-it-yourself sort of repairs that may work, may not work. So, a little bit of bush mechanic going on.
Yeah, no, it's always good to see. Well, thank you so much. I'm sorry you've had such a tough season. I hope you are able to get a crop off, but that sand was quite something. That would have been, what, 30, 40 centimetres deep in some parts?
Yeah, it was. Like, I couldn't believe it. I actually just walked down like, you are kidding me. Like, I'm not believing what I'm seeing. Like, I've got to take a photo of this, because any sort of luck, we never see it again. But, yeah, no, the season hasn't been great. We're getting seed back. We won't have anything else, but just incredibly grateful for the bit that we have got.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Yep, no problems. Thank you, Cassie.
Louise Smith there from McGee in the Mallee, and Ebony Daring from Dutton in the Mid-North actually did enter a photo into the Best Machinery Selfie section, into the competition, and enjoys photography and enjoys showing people what they get up to on their property.
I guess I've got a bit of an interest in photography and the farm, because that's our life, but I don't know, I just saw it as a good opportunity. There were a range of different topics, obviously. I don't think the one that mine won in had, you know, as many as some of the others. I remember there might have been about 70 or so other photos entered into that.
Have you been following the Harvesting the Crop page for a long time?
Not really. My husband has longer, probably been doing it for maybe 5 or 6 months, I think. What happened is we started up a Facebook page for our own farm, and then I've basically started following, you know, try to find a few farm related pages for that page then to follow, if that makes sense.
And what made you want to get into this space on social media around really targeting farmers?
There's probably a few reasons, but you know, farmers, they work a lot, and they don't really get, I don't see that they get the recognition for what they actually do. And I think this was one way to sort of, they put in so much effort in what they do, and a lot of it goes unseen. They're producing food for the world, basically, and I think this was one way to sort of just show the world what we as farmers actually get up to, and make that connection between where food comes from and those that don't really get to see that on a daily basis. And generally, like, everyone's seems to be really helpful on there and courteous of each other and stuff, so that's good.
Ebony Daring from Dutton speaking there, and it's quite a lot of members, 100,000 followers now on a site that I know a lot of you do like to engage with, this to have some banter or find out some information. So there you go. It's got international interest as well as interest from farmers across Australia. It is 13 minutes to one.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, it is the time of year when ABC celebrates young people across regional and rural areas. The winners of the annual Hayfire Storytelling Competition have been announced today. And this is young people across the country sharing candid accounts of what life is like beyond the capital cities. Eyre Peninsula winner Megan Allen has lived through years of drought near Woodna, and she knows how deeply it affects farmers, families and mental health. Now, drought is something her community talks about every day, even when it hardly comes up in the city, and so this is what she focused her winning story on. Brooke Neindorf caught up with Megan and asked her how she felt when she was announced as the EP winner.
I was a little bit shocking. I was actually not expecting it, because I just entered the poem and I wasn't 100% sure if that was the right format. But it was, yeah, very shocking and overwhelming at first, and it didn't really sink in until I got up home and I was like telling Mum and Dad, and my sister, I think she was the most excited. But yeah.
So what prompted you to write this story, write this poem?
Well, just coming off the back of the drought in 2025, and it was just not a very great year. Like, obviously, I fell off a horse and I had a lot of problems, but we had a lot of, there was a lot of trouble with like PERSA and the landscape board and all that sort of stuff. So it kind of like, I was laying in bed and the poem got stuck in my head. So I wrote it down. And then Miss G, one of the teachers at school, was telling us about this haywire thing at assembly. And I'm like, oh, maybe I should have a look at it. So I entered it and I looked at my poem and I kind of did a bit of discussion around it. And then I sent that in and surprise, surprise.
And there you go. So tell us a little bit about, you mentioned there about the drought and the tough things that you and your family have been going through, but tell us a little bit about what is a part of your haywire entry.
What I'm trying to do through the story is kind of bring awareness to that we have had a drought in SA and it's been a pretty big one. I know people have been throwing the phrase around that it's the driest year in 100. So what I wanted to do was I drew from a couple of real life experiences. So one day, Dad and I were walking in Woolies, and I will paraphrase a little bit here. He went, we're walking down the meat aisle, and he's like, oh my golly gosh, that's more than the sheep. And so it kind of just really made me stop and be like, oh my gosh, you know, they're getting affected as well through this. Like, we're getting, you know, bugger all for our sheep, and these people are like having to pay like a lot. So there's obviously some middleman going on there.
And so I guess, is it also about trying to share with city people what you're going through?
Definitely, because I feel like there's a big gap between them. They don't actually understand what it's like. And like I mentioned before, you've got the big wigs trying to tell you what to do, but they actually have never lived it and they've never experienced it.
And so how has it been at your place this year? How would you describe it up at Woodna?
Look, it's been really dry. We're quite lucky now, because it has rained and we've got a fair bit of feed, and you know, it's so good to be able to look around and actually see feed and cover on the ground. But you know, where we're in a good position, the rest of SA is not, and that is still dry. But it's, I know when that big hay run came through, Dad said that we don't need any hay because we've got a little bit of green coming up now, and he let it go to some other people from that. So I thought that was really good of him. He's quite a nice guy when he wants to be.
Your story, I guess, probably not only describes just what's happening at your place, but right across South Australia.
Yeah, I'm trying to, like, it's inspired by, like, it's not just my experience. Like, there's hundreds of little kids, and you're at school and you've got receptions there saying about, oh, it's dry, and you know, and it kind of brings into think that it's actually everyone in rural towns that are affected by this, and obviously city people as well, but it's everyone's affected in some way.
What are you looking forward to most about your haywire experience?
Oh, I'm actually not sure. I'm really not sure what to expect. Like, it's. I think being able to actually hear on the radio is going to be a good one. I'm probably not going to like the sound of my own voice. I can tell you that right now. But
you'll get used to it. Have you been to Canberra before?
I was supposed to go this year. I think I went when I was little, but I can't remember that. I was supposed to go this year for the Canberra trip at school, but I had a fall off a horse and I dislocated my hip and did a stuff round and I wasn't allowed to go. But my mother and brother and all them went because my mum's a school teacher.
Well, how are you now after falling off your horse?
Good. I've just had an ankle recon, so wow. I'm still coming back. It's been a huge year.
And I imagine having horses as well, that's been hard too, being able to source feed and that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. We've got a lot of horses, but the hay goes a lot further for them because we can chaff it where it doesn't really for sheep. And you kind of just got to make it work. Like, that's a big part of it. You can't sit around and, you know, say, oh, it's dry, it's, you know, there's no rain, you know, what are we going to do? You actually have to do it. Like, you just have to suck it up and get it over and done with. And that's what people don't understand.
When you go to Canberra as part of the Haywire Youth Forum early next year, you'll be sort of in front of, you know, ministers and people over there in power. What are you maybe hoping to get across to them when you go over?
Pull your act together. I was a Royal Youth Ambassador this year, so I've had a little bit of experience with SA politicians. I don't know. I think I just want them to realise that they can sit up there in their office and make all these laws and regulations and whatnot, and unless they've actually lived it, they don't know. They've got a degree. They don't have experience.
This year, drought swept across South Australia. Out here in Woodna, it's all we talk about. But in the city, it's barely a conversation. I realised that one afternoon in Adelaide. When I mentioned the drought to a cashier, they had no idea we were even in one. No idea that back home, families were struggling, animals were dying, and the land was crying out for rain. At home, it's different. Every time Dad runs into someone down the street, it's always, "Bit dry, isn't it, mate?" And they stand there, talking about the rain that never came. Because when there's no rain, there's no hay. And when hay costs our family $500 a bale, we can't feed our sheep. Bills don't stop coming. When livestock prices crash, the stress builds up. Around our district, it is not unusual for farmers to be on medication for depression. That's what drought does. It doesn't just dry up the land, it dries up hope. And out here, there's nowhere near enough support. The nearest counsellor can be hours away, and even then, it's hard for people to ask for help. They just keep going, because that's what farmers do. People in the city don't see empty dams or dust storms rolling across paddocks, but they do see the prices at the supermarket. I remember walking through Woolies with Dad once, and he pointed at the meat section and said, "That's worth more than the sheep itself!" And that's when it hit me. People in the city see prices rise, but they don't always see the struggle behind them. But they still feel the effects of it. Writing has always been my way of making sense of it all. When the words get stuck in my head, I write poems or stories. One day, I want to be a horse trainer like my dad and an equine vet. The drought will come again. It always does. But so will the rain. And maybe city people won't ever fully see what it's like. The waiting, the worry, the toll of dry years. No matter how dry it gets, a bit of understanding goes a long way. It doesn't bring the rain, but it reminds us of what it feels like when it finally comes.
abc.net.au/Haywire
2025 EP Haywire winner Megan Allen from Woodner, and she's speaking with Brooke Neindorf about her perspective on the South Australian drought. And as was mentioned there, all the winners will be travelling to Canberra in January for the Haywire Regional Youth Summit. And you can find out more and see other great stories by young regional Australians at haywire.net.au/Haywire. If you're interested, we will be rolling out stories from the other South Australian winners as well. But just to let you know, the North and West winner was Reese from Maitland. Reese wrote about the shutdown of the 3G tower and what it means for internet and phone coverage on his family's property. Vishwa from Renmark wrote about finding your place in a new community, which isn't always easy, particularly when you've moved halfway around the world. Hanalee from Mount Gambier, she talks about putting on the bright yellow Country Fire Service uniform, and she couldn't keep the smile off her face. So she still wears most of that same uniform and smile to training each week. And in Broken Hill, Geordie wrote about a diagnosis of ADHD and dyslexia, which helped her explain the learning differences that she experienced. So congratulations to all the South Australian winners, and I hope you have a great time in Canberra. I think all of the students and the people who are involved in that get a lot out of that trip. We'll head across to the markets though now, where Peter Kerr has the results from the southeast markets. Good afternoon, Peter.
Good afternoon, Cassie. This is the Mount Gambier Cattle Report for the 10th of December. Numbers remain steady. Agents yarded 1,580 head of live weight and open auction cattle. These sold to another large field of trade and processor buyers, with feeder and restock orders also active throughout the offering. Quality was good over the pens as the market followed recent trends to sell to cheaper rates. Dealer steers attracted the trade from 421 to 502 cents to drop 25 cents. A similar heifers made from 405 to 470. Feeder orders operated here to 434 cents on steers and to 464 cents a kilogram on the heifer portion. Yearling steers to the trade mostly sold from 420 to 460 with feeders active to 464 and some restockers support to 450 cents a kilogram. Yearling heifers followed similar rates to sell from also 420 to 450 with sales to the trade, feeders and restocker orders. Growing steers and bullocks lost 15 cents to sell from 430 to 480 cents to the trade. Feeders operated here from 385 to 470. Growing heifers lost 20 cents to range from 366 to 450 cents to trade buyers. Feeders were active from 405 to 470 as manufacturing steers returned from 365 to 384 cents a kilogram. Heavy cows sold from 374 to 412 cents to fall up to 25 cents. Lighter lots from 300 to 372 with the bulls, making from mostly 375 to 438 cents a kilogram. This has been Peter Kerr for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks for that, Peter. And we didn't receive a report from Dublin this week, so we don't have any results from the sheep and cattle sale there. But so that's all we have time for in the program. To find out more on what's happening in agriculture across Australia, go online to abc.net.au/rural. It's almost 1 o'clock, though, so it's approaching time for news. Have a great day, everyone.
The Country Hour, part of your community and your life.
Oh, it's a bit of mix.
For 80 years.
Everything is buzzing and eating.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories.
That's all part of the magic.
On ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.